You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
This past January, the people of southern Sudan voted overwhelmingly to separate from the Arab North, paving the way to becoming a separate nation. But that doesn't affect Darfur, the western region of Sudan, where violence and displacement continue to persist. Advocacy groups made Darfur a critical issue in U.S. foreign policy, but many believe that the impending split has diverted attention away from the troubled area. In her book, Fighting for Darfur, Public Action and the Struggle to Stop Genocide, Rebecca Hamilton looks at the successes, setbacks, and lessons learned by the advocacy movements that sought to stop genocide and influence U.S. public policy in the region. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan, and I'm very pleased to welcome Rebecca Hamilton to our show today. Hello.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
To date, it's reported that 450,000 people have been killed in Darfur, nearly a half a million people, and over 2.5 million have been displaced. What's the situation there right now? Have things calmed down a bit?
No, if anything, the situation is getting worse there than it has been in the last few years. I should say that for listeners out there who still imagine Darfur to be the place that it was in 2003 and 2004 when there were these enormous massacres by the government against non-Arab groups, that is no longer the way to characterize the situation in Darfur today. What instead you have is the government launching a military campaign to try and get rid of the remainder of the rebel movements, displacing again very large amounts of people and fractured rebel movements. In addition, Arab groups that were fighting against the government back in 2003 and 2004, some of them are now joining the other rebel groups.
Now, most of the people in Darfur are Muslims, so this is not a religious thing, as
That's
it
right.
was with the South.
Right.
But it's Arabs and then black Africans, is that it?
Yeah. I mean, if you break it down on ethnic lines, there are a number of different ethnic groups that are broadly characterized as Arab groups tend to be more nomadic, non-Arab groups tend to be farmers in Darfur.
Are humanitarian and other kinds of organizations and journalists still prevented from going into the region?
There is a UN operation in there right now, but that is very seriously constrained by the government. There are also different aid organizations, but they've had a history of being expelled by this government. And these days it's very difficult for journalists to get in.
Has the end of fighting in the South, or relative end of fighting in the South, freed the Sudanese government to focus more on Darfur?
That may indeed be the case. You're seeing this ramping up of its military campaign again, I think because it doesn't need to be doing that so much in the South anymore.
And if the South does secede, as we assume it will, what impact do you think that'll have on Darfur?
I think it puts Darfur in a very difficult position because you are going to have all of the international community investing in the project of nation building in the new southern Sudan. To do that, to create this independent new nation, it's going to take a lot of financial and diplomatic resources. What is left to be pressuring Khartoum over with regard to Darfur?
Isn't there a Darfur peace process taking place in Doha?
There is indeed, but it has been going on for a very long time with very limited signs of success, in part because the rebel movements are no longer the simple couple of groups that you had at the beginning of the conflict back in 2003 and 2004, and instead have fractured into many disparate groups.
And the same sort of thing has happened in the South. The new nation will have to contend with a whole bunch of disparate groups that don't seem to be able to agree on much other than the fact that they want an independent nation.
That is true. That's a risk for the South. Although part of the reason that the South was able to get a peace agreement back in 2005 is that it did have one rebel group that emerged as the main negotiating partner. Darfur doesn't have that.
How does the fighting in Darfur differ from the 20-year civil war in the South?
You know, actually, the 2003 and 2004 campaign in Darfur was in many ways very similar. The government had rehearsed, if you like, its strategies in the South. So the government would fly overhead with its air force in a coordinated campaign with proxy militia that it was using on the ground. These days, what you're seeing in Darfur is something different. Yes, a mass displacement of people, but also a lot of fighting over land that had been cleared in 2003 and 2004.
Is that what this is really all about, land?
In large part, it is a conflict over land, yes.
In what way? I mean, there is an indigenous people, You'd assume that the Sudanese government would just try to work with them. Are they trying to get rid of them and bring in some other people?
So the conflict over land, you need to back up a little bit in terms of Darfur history. And certainly during the 80s, a huge amount of desertification and a narrowing of usable land. And there had been traditional ways of resolving this between the nomads and the farmers in Darfur. But once you had sort of post-Cold War era weapons flows and also ideology, interestingly enough, coming from Libya to create a pan-Arab belt in this region, then these land conflicts became much more violent and much more polarized along ethnic lines.
But when we're talking about ethnic lines, we're talking about 90 ethnic minorities in the Darfur region. Right. So it's not just Arabs and non-Arabs. It's not just farmers and nomads.
Exactly.
Is this just the legacy of nation building in Africa during the colonial era? Because Sudan is this huge country, but it seems to me to be a lot of different little possible countries.
Sure. And I think you could tell that same story for, as you say, any country in Africa. The colonial borders were not done in consultation with the people that were actually living there.
Well, we've seen real problems in the former Belgian colonies. After Belgium left Burundi and Congo, immediately civil wars broke out. And then later Rwanda had its problems, which is also a legacy of Belgian policies. Are we seeing the same sort of thing in Sudan as a result of the British colonial period?
I think the British colonial period had a huge impact on the fact that we're having, you know, we had a referendum last month on the separation of southern Sudan, because during British rule, they effectively ruled Sudan as if it were already two nations. And they had a northern administration and a southern administration. And the British really didn't get down into the south. They ruled from the north.
In Khartoum.
From Khartoum, a primarily Arab and Muslim population. And in the south, they sent in missionaries who conducted a process of obviously educating the population to be English-speaking, as well as creating a growth of Christianity in the south. And then, of course, the British abruptly left and handed over rule to people in the north who tried to define Sudan not as these sort of two administrations or countries, but as an Arab and Islamic state. And that was the source of the initial Sudanese civil war between north and south.
My guest is Rebecca Hamilton, a special correspondent for The Washington Post in Sudan, with support from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting and a fellow at the New America Foundation. She's written a book called Fighting for Darfur, Public Action and the Struggle to Stop Genocide. It is published by Palgrave Macmillan. Your book focuses on the advocacy movements and international policy to end genocide in Sudan. Well, first of all, let's talk about genocide. Is this really a case of genocide, since we're talking about so many different groups?
Look, that's a debate that will be ongoing for very much longer than today. The advice that Colin Powell, who made the U.S. determination of genocide, the U.S. was the only country who called it genocide, the legal advice that he was given was you can argue it one way or you can argue it the other. There are very compelling arguments to be made on either side of this equation, and the debate turns over not whether the acts that constitute genocide, the mass killings, the mass rapes that were ethnically targeted happened. They absolutely did. The question is whether you meet the legal standard of genocide, which is a special intent.
And Colin Powell made that announcement in 2004 that this was a genocide. You say that it hadn't been discussed much in the White House. Was he acting largely on his own?
He was. It was a decision that was taken within the State Department. And 2 days before he went before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and made that determination, he went in to see President Bush and said, you know, by the way, I will be calling this genocide on Thursday, at which point Bush said to Condoleezza Rice, well, you'd better let the principals of the other agencies know so that they're not surprised.
But what implications came from labeling it a genocide? The United States policy didn't seem to change all that much, did it?
Right. So Powell's, when you talk to him, why then did he call it genocide, knowing that he didn't have the support of the rest of the U.S. government to actually do anything? He says he was hoping that by calling it genocide, he would get other countries on the U.N. Security Council to act. Now, of course, other countries on the UN Security Council, we're talking September 2004 here, had a very clear memory of Powell standing before them just 18 months before and saying there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. So it didn't have that impact. If anything, it isolated the US position from the rest of the world on this internationally, but it had an enormous impact in creating this new citizens' movement.
Well, it also came at a time when photographs from
Abu Ghraib
were being released. It made the United States look a bit hypocritical, didn't it?
A bit, more than a bit hypocritical, absolutely.
Well, how much of this was also a feeling that we didn't want to see a repeat of what happened in Rwanda? Because you write, the analogy to Rwanda, so effective at gaining attention to Darfur, did not end up serving Darfuris well when the lessons were carried over into the policy realm because of the very different contexts, both local and international, in which these two man-made tragedies unfolded.
Right. So the analogy to Rwanda, which was really the way that Darfur managed to break through into the mainstream media. There were massacres in Darfur in 2003 that nobody in the mainstream media was covering. But what enabled Darfur to break through was an analogy that was drawn to Rwanda at the 10th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide in April 2004. That's when you saw Darfur enter public consciousness. So the analogy was effective in the sense that it got media attention and it gave people a hook, a way to understand this very complicated place of Darfur. But as you say, there's over 90 different ethnic groups in Darfur. This idea that it was just sort of a two ethnicity conflict was simplistic. And in particular, the trouble was that advocates took the policy lessons from Rwanda and from the U.S. failure in Rwanda and applied them directly to Darfur, failing to update for the new context.
And I remember at the beginning I was hearing that this was a conflict between the Muslims in the north and the Christians and animists in the south.
And that would be a totally different part of Sudan.
But then Darfur's name would be attached to that, even though Darfur isn't in the south. Right. But so in 2004, is that when the first advocacy groups formed?
Yes, although, even 2004, it was just the very beginnings of advocacy. I wouldn't say that they actually got organized until early 2005.
And who were these young advocates? Were they politically connected?
No, they're really interesting. It was a pretty diverse group, mostly characterized, though, by the fact that they hadn't been involved in human rights advocacy before and had no history with Sudan. So you had certainly a huge student component in this. You had a large Jewish constituency who were obviously motivated by the fact that it was called genocide and wished to be upstanders against genocide. You also had eventually coming in, there had been an enormous southern Sudan constituency of evangelical Christians and the Congressional Black Caucus who had been advocating for a different part of Sudan for many years before and who were belatedly brought into the Darfur movement.
It was my sense when we started talking about this that most people had no idea what was really going on in Sudan, what the history of Sudan was, who Bashir was and how he came to power. Was that a problem with the advocacy groups? How sophisticated were they about what Sudan's history was all about?
At the beginning, not at all sophisticated. I mean, they came in on a narrative of Darfur is genocide and we want to stop this being another situation where the U.S. fails to prevent genocide like in Rwanda. So they weren't grounded in the history of Sudan. Over time, the advocacy leaders have become much more sophisticated. The trouble is when you're dealing with a mass constituency, it can be difficult to update them and to build on the layers of nuance that the advocacy leaders were themselves learning.
Were they getting any hearings in Congress?
Very many.
And was Congress responding? What was happening in Washington?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most effective part of this Darfur advocacy movement was their relationship with Congress. They did things that, frankly, an organization like the NRA perfected years ago. Very simple things like issuing scorecards, grading members of Congress on how they were doing on Darfur. But members of Congress weren't used to hearing from constituents on a foreign policy issue, let alone one that was involving Muslims as victims in an area with no strategic interest to the U.S. And so they were taken aback by this and paid a great deal of attention.
Although they had been approached as early as 2002, you say, by a Sudanese activist who was living in the United States, Omar Ismail.
Yes, he's a Darfuri, a Darfuri diaspora, who was trying, he wasn't approaching Congress at that time, but he was trying to get members of the administration to pay attention to the warning signs that were already there in Darfur, trying and failing to get any traction at that point.
My guest is Rebecca Hamilton. Her book, Fighting for Darfur, Public Action and the Struggle to Stop Genocide, it's published by Palgrave Macmillan. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Rebecca Hamilton, who's a special correspondent for The Washington Post in Sudan. In 2007, she was selected as a global young leader in genocide prevention for spearheading the campaign for Harvard University to divest from companies doing business with Sudan and working with internally displaced populations in Sudan. She's written a book called Fighting for Darfur, Public Action and Struggle to Stop Genocide. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan. You write that a popular mantra for many of the young advocates was something written by Samantha Powers about genocides in the 20th century. It is in the realm of U.S. domestic politics that the battle to stop genocides is lost. And I'm assuming that people felt that was true for Darfur as well.
That is absolutely the core of the advocacy movement that started was on the basis of that lesson.
Didn't President George W. Bush appoint a special envoy to Sudan as early as 2001? What led him to do that?
That was largely because of this Southern Sudan advocacy constituency that I was talking about earlier, the Evangelical Christian Community, the Congressional Black Caucus. And they actually met with Bush a week after he came into office and urged him to make peace in Southern Sudan, a different place from Darfur, obviously, a foreign policy priority.
Wasn't the United States also feeling a bit kindly towards Sudan around that time? Because we had asked them to get rid of Osama bin Laden, who we didn't realize was then going to be behind 9/11 and so many other problems. But even then was seen as a serious problem. And Sudan asked him to leave. He wound up in Afghanistan as a result.
Right. That happened in the 90s. And then after 9/11, certainly Sudan really upped its counterterrorism cooperation with the U.S. government.
So on the one hand, we saw Sudan as a real problem and a source of terrorism. On the other hand, we saw it as a friend in the fight against terrorism.
Right, a very conflicted place for U.S. policy to be in.
Was there, after Colin Powell made that announcement about Sudan and genocide in Darfur, was there a plan of action by the U.S. that came as a result of it?
No. I mean, their plan, as best as I've been able to reconstruct at that point, was to get other members of the UN Security Council to act. The U.S. government felt that it had already done everything that it could do and had no place else to go on Darfur.
So we had a lot of good words, but little action.
Exactly.
And meanwhile, students are advocating. But then some celebrities become part of the whole thing. In fact, Mia Farrow wrote the preface to your book. How important was it that so many celebrities took up the cause?
I think it's had a hugely beneficial impact in terms of just general public consciousness. And I certainly know as a reporter, you know, fighting for a limited amount of foreign news coverage in the U.S. media, it's easier to convince an editor to run a Sudan story if, you know, George Clooney has just been in Sudan. They'll believe that there is an American audience out there who knows something about Sudan just by virtue of a celebrity having been there. So on the general public awareness-raising side, it can be good.
Now, we mentioned the United Nations. In Rwanda, one of the reasons the United Nations didn't act is because there were some countries that were opposed to any action. They actually were supporting the Hutu government that was behind the genocide.
Right.
Was there something similar happening with Sudan?
I mean, you had yes. In one way, yes. That was the role that China took up pretty much on Darfur. And the irony was that during Rwanda, you had the U.S. really being very reticent in terms of action at the UN Security Council. On Darfur, you had the U.S. trying to push forward, but being blocked all the way by Beijing.
And that's because China has economic interests in the country?
Exactly. The largest direct foreign investment and huge investments in the oil industry in Sudan.
Well, how much oil is there in Sudan?
I couldn't give you the exact figure, but they're the third largest oil-producing country in sub-Saharan Africa.
Wow.
So it's significant.
So Nigeria, and then I don't know what the second is, and then Sudan.
Right.
But that would also mean that China, which also has all sorts of other interests, wouldn't want to mess things up. But of all the countries in the world, perhaps they are the least likely to say, hey, we're concerned about human rights violations.
Exactly. Their approach is non-interference with domestic issues of other countries. So it was happy to continue an economic relationship with Sudan.
But they did adjust their policy because of the Beijing Olympics, didn't they?
Right. And it's the one, you know, in what is by and large a very depressing book, it's the one sort of shining chapter where there was a moment in which some of the advocates broke away from the script that you kind of read out at the beginning, that it's in the realm of domestic U.S. domestic politics where this battle is lost, and realized that by 2005, the road to pressure Khartoum was not through Washington but through Beijing. And they did a public shaming campaign. And it wasn't because they believed that you could get Beijing to really care about human rights abuses in Darfur, but they understood accurately, I think, that what Beijing did care about, what it saw in its own national interest, was its image in the build-up to the Olympics. And then by shaming that, they could get China to move.
So there was a little bit of serendipity. But how much actually happened as a result?
You had an immediate response in that 2 days after the campaign was launched, Beijing appointed a special envoy on Darfur. I don't think that means any significant change at the policy level. It just means they were paying attention. But then where you do see a shift is that in 2006, China had abstained from a UN Security Council resolution to get peacekeepers into Darfur. Khartoum read that very accurately as seeing that it didn't actually have to implement the resolution. China wasn't supporting it. A year later, China supported what was essentially the exact same mandate. And if you talk to anyone at the UN Security Council during that time, they say that what caused that policy shift over the course of a year was this Genocide Olympics campaign.
Has there been any talk of sending troops into Sudan as a result of Darfur? I mean, right now there's a big debate over whether we should create a no-fly zone over Libya, despite the fact that Muammar al-Gaddafi is bombing his own people and everybody's outraged. Nobody seems to want to do anything.
Well, in Darfur, you do have a very large, at this point, UN peacekeeping contingent. I don't think there is any question that U.S. troops would not be a useful addition to what is happening on the ground in Darfur, if
Although,
anything.
I don't think the United States wants to get involved. In fact, didn't Secretary of Defense Gates say after Afghanistan and Iraq, we're unlikely to go anywhere else for quite a long time?
And certainly it would be the wrong thing to do in any case in Darfur. I don't think that anyone is pushing for that at this point in time.
We went into Iraq because some people argued Saddam Hussein had a tyrannical regime. Was the situation in Sudan much better?
You know, I think that it was argued that Saddam Hussein had a tyrannical regime after the fact. I think we might have gone in regardless of what he was doing on human rights. But again, no one was ever really pushing for the U.S. to intervene forcefully in Darfur. Because it would have been used by Khartoum as a rallying call for jihadists globally to intervene, and that would have ended up in a very bad situation for the civilians, who are the people that we should have been protecting.
One of the groups you write about is the Save Darfur movement. How big did this organization get, and what sort of impact did it have on U.S. policy?
It grew rapidly. It started with one man with a listserv of, you know, 100 names, and that listserv grew to 1 million people. And they were able to very rapidly turn out thousands of people to lobby Congress. You had the big rallies back in 2006 on the Mall. Their biggest positive impact, I think, looking back, is probably in terms of congressional appropriations. They managed to get $2 billion appropriated for Darfur between 2005 and 2008. That was second only to Iraq and Afghanistan, 10 times more than any other African country. So on that, you can say, yes, clear benefit. On other things, there was an extent to which they were barking up the wrong tree.
How were they funded?
How was the Save Darfur movement funded? Well, there's an interesting story. So they were getting donations from citizens, but something that was, I think, unknown to most of the public at the time was they also had an anonymous donor who called them up in 2006 offering tens of millions of dollars to this organization, but with a condition. And the condition was that they spent it on paid public advertising. So if you were in New York in 2007, you'll remember if you walked through the subway, there would always be these massive Saved Our Four billboards. They were not there because Saved Our Four made a choice to spend its general budget on advertising. They were there because the donor that they accepted funding from was making it a condition of his donation.
And was that effective?
You know, on the general public awareness raising of Darfur, I'm sure it had an impact. But it vastly distorted the mission of the organization and meant that a lot of their resources were devoted to not keeping up to date with exactly what was happening on the ground, but putting out these public ads.
Now, you mentioned that a UN force went into Sudan. Actually, isn't it really an African force?
It's a hybrid AU-UN force, but you're right in that the soldiers themselves are almost entirely African.
And it requires the cooperation of Sudan, which hasn't always been cooperative. So how effective can they be?
They've had a real tough time being effective because, as you say, they are there as a consensual force. It wasn't an invasion. It wasn't a non-consensual deployment. They are supposed to be peacekeepers, which means having the consent of the host government. And Sudan was pressured into letting them, you know, actually deploy. But that doesn't mean that they liked it or have been cooperative.
And then there's the whole matter of the International Criminal Court. What impact did the advocates have on referring the Darfur crisis to the ICC?
You know, actually very little. And I think that's one of the poorly understood aspects of the story. We imagine that this was something that the advocacy community would have jumped on. But in actual fact, the referral happened in March of 2005. The advocacy community really hadn't got organized. They were doing their basic organization building at that point. And the story of how it was that Darfur got referred to the ICC is a story of very sophisticated diplomacy by European and African nations, ensuring that the U.S. would let it go through.
But the United States didn't initially support it. Eventually did?
They abstained from the referral. In other words, they didn't use their veto to stop it going through, but they didn't fully endorse it like they have just done with Libya.
Before we continue with the ICC case, a listener wants to know if there are some American companies that continue to invest in Sudan.
You know, U.S. companies haven't been able to invest in Sudan since 1997. President Clinton, as a result of this terrorism issue and the human rights abuses in the South, issued comprehensive economic sanctions, and they've stayed in place. There are no, you know, U.S. companies in the oil industry, for example, in Sudan right now.
Has that hurt Sudan at all? The sanctions really pressured South Africa to change policy, but you get the feeling that Sudan doesn't care.
Certainly over the last 5 years, they've been able to survive very nicely, thank you, without the U.S. Because of China and the support from the Gulf states. However, that may be changing because as the South separates, it's going to lose a huge amount of the oil revenue, and it's got this enormous amount of external debt right now. So I think that's a changing calculation.
And there will be some changes in the Gulf states possibly.
Indeed.
There has been some criticism of the ICC's indictment of President al-Bashir of Sudan, mainly because it has resulted in the expulsion of humanitarian organizations from the country. Given the precarious situation and the person we're dealing with here, was it the best action to take?
Look, I think you have to disentangle a little bit what the ICC did and what Bashir did. It was Bashir's choice to expel those organizations, and he had already been expelling organizations before the ICC issued its arrest warrant, and he's been suspending organizations subsequent to that. I think it gave him a very convenient excuse, which he used well from his perspective. But certainly the immediate impact on the ground was devastating.
Are you surprised that he's been so willing to go along with the result of the plebiscite?
Yes.
That even allowed the plebiscite?
Right. And I think I'm not the only one who's surprised. 3 months ago, I would not have expected this referendum to have happened so successfully.
Well, it might have hurt the ICC action might have actually hurt the peace process because the natural reaction on his part would have been just to simply say, I'm not going to do anything that has to do with what the West wants.
Are you talking about the North-South peace process? Because that was something different from the ICC's indictment, which was over actions in Darfur.
I understand, but if you're indicted for human rights violations and you've already had this war in which you've been accused of human rights violations in the South, at a certain point you might just simply say, you know what, I'm not going to do any of this.
Right. He may have said that. And I think what was on the table was the promise of the U.S. lifting the state sponsors of terrorism designation on Sudan. And Bashir seeing that his economy was increasingly fragile and that to maintain his rule, to maintain his internal support, it's not that he's widely loved by the people, but there is a patronage system in place. And to keep that in place, the money needs to keep flowing.
How enforceable is the ICC's indictment?
Well, the ICC doesn't have its own police force, and so it's completely dependent on the security apparatus of different nation states. So in Sudan right now, he's very safe from the arrest warrant being executed. The issue, though, is when he travels to other countries that have joined the International Criminal Court, that they might arrest him. And so that's what you're seeing, a shift in his travel arrangements.
In 2007, people started calling into question the whole matter of whether the situation in Darfur could still be called a genocide because the number of deaths had decreased, and what they really were concerned more was with the displacement, the refugee camps, and the like. How did that affect policy and attention to Darfur?
You know, I think the use of the word genocide was for the longest time what was required to keep public attention. It's interesting to me now that you're getting public attention on something like Libya, which is clearly not a genocide but may involve crimes against humanity. So maybe we have finally passed the point where you have to call something genocide in order to get attention to it. But it skewed the policy process in that people took within the policy environment understood that if it was genocide, then you would prioritize security over a peace agreement.
But don't we also focus on one thing at a time? For example, it's been pointed out that the situation in the Côte d'Ivoire may even be worse than the situation in Libya, where Gbagbo is killing a lot of his citizens as well in his attempt to hold on to power. But we're talking about Libya. We're not talking about the Ivory Coast.
Right. And that's a perennial problem.
Often say it's because that's sub-Saharan Africa. I don't know if that applies in the case of Sudan, because Darfur has become an international issue.
It did become an international issue. But think about, you know, for any of you out there, how long since you've seen a mainstream media article on Darfur? It's very rare, in fact, to be doing a show focused on Darfur at the moment. We've switched attention entirely to what's happening in southern Sudan. So even within one country, it's as if we can't hold more than one narrative about this place at a time.
And are Darfuris aware of this?
Yes, and feeling very abandoned by the international community at this point.
What's happening in the refugee camps?
A huge amount of frustration that people are in a state of limbo and they can't return to their land. It's not secure. They're not being, you know, there are not the massacres of 2003, 2004, but that doesn't mean that it's a great place to be in Darfur.
If you look back at the Darfur advocacy groups 5 or 6 years ago, how have they evolved? Are they all in agreement with what to do today?
You know, they went through a massive period of fracturing as I think some in the movement started to realize that the solution to Darfur could not be found through Washington. They went through this process of fracturing. And I think what you're seeing now is a sort of regrouping again and trying to recast themselves not just as a movement for Darfur, but as a movement against mass atrocities wherever they occur.
Rebecca Hamilton's book is Fighting for Darfur, Public Action and the Struggle to Stop Genocide. It is published by Palgrave Macmillan. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.